In this video, we're going to look at Acts chapter 27. So open your Bibles to Acts chapter 27. This chapter covers Paul's journey to Rome under arrest. He's to appear before Caesar. Now, it's not the full trip to Rome. It's just the sea voyage part of that trip. So the chapter opens with verse 1, and when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some of the other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. So Paul is now under the care slash arrest of Julius, the centurion. It's interesting. One has said you could put a title over this chapter calling it Paul carries the gospel to Rome, courtesy of the Roman government. And that's really what it was, courtesy of the Roman government. They paid for the boat ride and everything. Looked after Paul, cared for Paul, and so on. And as we see, as the chapter develops, that this centurion, Julius, became quite an admirer of Paul, we believe, and at least deeply respected him. It was one of the interesting things about the centurions that are recorded in the New Testament, all are presented in quite a positive light. Now, I know they were not all good guys. History records that. A lot of the Roman soldiers were pretty rough. But all the ones mentioned, at least the centurions of the New Testament, are put in a pretty good light. And so Julius goes and he hires a ship from Adramyttium, which is on Mysia on the coast of Asia. Now, they didn't catch the ship there, but the ship was based out of that port. They're sailing from Caesarea on the Mediterranean coast next to Judea, in Judea. So we see another person in the boat along with Paul. We find in verse 2, Aristarchus, Macedonian of Thessalonica. Now we read about him in Acts chapter 19. He's involved in that great riot in the theater in Ephesus, and they would have torn him limb from limb there. It's also mentioned that he's a traveling companion of Paul. Then we find in Colossians chapter 4, verse 10, Aristarchus is in the, or Aristarchus, however it's pronounced in English, is in under house arrest in Rome. That we'll find when we come to chapter 28. Paul is 2 years in Rome under house arrest, and Aristarchus is with him there. Colossians chapter 4, verse 10 notes this, as a fellow prisoner of Paul. So he's Paul's companion and helper, and he's with them all the way. But he was originally from Thessalonica, from the assembly in Thessalonica. So Paul has these faithful ones with him, like Luke. Luke has joined. We see that in verse 1 where it says, we should sail to Italy. You know, Luke now has joined Paul as well. He hadn't been with Paul for about 2 years, for Paul was, you know, under arrest in Caesarea. He had to stand before these tribunals, these examinations under Felix and Festus. So now that Paul is out of the jail or the palace, the praetorium there in Caesarea on his way to Rome by ship, Luke joins him and records this journey, in which, you know, we get so much detail, probably more detail in this chapter about this event than any other chapter or any other event, I should say, connected with Paul in the book of Acts. But we may comment on that a little more when we come to the close. Why is that? Why are we getting so much detail here about this trip? But I better move along because I don't want to make it too long. But just by way of introduction here, we've mentioned these points. And so it says in verse 3, the next day we landed at Sidon, which is on the, you know, the coast, the Mediterranean coast there, which is today Lebanon. And it mentions that Julius, the centurion, treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. Now, there's probably an assembly by now in Sidon, and Julius lets him out. So we see that as far as Julius, the centurion, is concerned, Paul's no ordinary prisoner. You wouldn't think that, you know, a prisoner would be let loose, but I don't think Julius viewed Paul that way. He viewed him as a respectable man and perhaps just a godly rabbi, or however he understood Paul to be. Nevertheless, he trusted Paul and he cared for Paul. And so we see God's providence in this. And so he met with the Christians in Sidon and received some care and encouragement there, and maybe some supplies and refreshments and so on to take with him on the trip. So verse 4, when we had put out to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, the island of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. So instead of going out into the ocean, heading for Crete, the island of Crete, which would be the first sort of landing spot, they sail on the lee side of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And then in verse 5, and when we had sailed over to the sea, which is off of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, to a city of Lycia on the coast of Asia there, the south coast of Asia, which is today Turkey. And then the centurion switched boats or ships. It says in verse 6, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. Now, I don't know if the original plan was to eventually to stop at Crete, but that's where they will end up. We'll get to that when we come to it. But the Alexandrian ship here was a government ship. As part of the imperial fleet, the grain fleet. Alexandria was in Egypt, the great city of Alexandria, founded by Alexander the Great. And Egypt was sort of the bread basket, the grain basket of the Roman Empire. And so the Roman government had ships under contract. They were privately owned ships, but were under contract to the Roman government to go to Egypt, to go to Alexandria and load up with grain and bring it back to Rome. And then from there, be distributed to various parts of the empire. So that's why it's called an Alexandrian ship, part of the imperial grain fleet. And so we see that when Julius comes on board, because it's an imperial ship under the command of the empire, as soon as Julius steps on board, he's a senior officer. He's just like a captain, not in the, you know, in the you know, the details of sailing, but simply in authority. So they all got on board, verse 6, on the second ship, headed for Italy, a grain ship. Verse 7, and when we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off of Cnidus, that's in Southeast Asia, again, modern-day Turkey, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone, passing it with difficulty. We came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lasia. So they pull into the island of Crete because the winds were very contrary and it was really slow going. And they pulled into a place called Fair Havens. And the thought was there they were going to shelter on Crete until the winter storms had passed. We get this coming out in verse 9. Now, when much time had been spent and sailing now was dangerous because the fast was already over. The fast mentioned there is the Day of Atonement. Okay, the Day of Atonement, depending on the year, depending on the calendar year, because it was a different date each year, was either the end of September, middle end of September, or even October. Okay, and so that was already now passed. So they were getting into perhaps November, the end of October, early November here, and the winter storms were now brewing on the Mediterranean and associated, you know, seas, the different gulfs connected with the Mediterranean, and it wouldn't have been safe to travel. So there was a bit of a debate broke out amongst the people in authority on the boat, actually between Paul and the others, between Paul and Julius and the officers of the ship and so on, whether they should stay in Fair Havens or move further up the coast of the island of Crete. So let's just read it and then we'll explain a little more. Verse 9. Now when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because of the fast, the Day of Atonement, was already over, Paul advised them, saying, men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion, that is Julius, was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. So the debate was this. Paul is telling them, if we move away from Fair Havens, we could get into big trouble. He had a sense in the spirit that there was going to be disaster at the end of this, and they should just stay put in on the port of Fair Havens on the island of Crete. But the debate from the others, that is from the helmsman and, you know, the first officers, captain, the owner of the ship, you know, the sailors, basically, those who knew sailing, their thought was, no, let's just sail a little further up the coast on the island of Crete. That can't be any problem. And we'll pull in at a place called Phoenix, was only 60 kilometers west on the island of Crete, not a big distance. So naturally speaking, you know, humanly speaking, you could see their argument there, that let's just go up because the harbor is better there to winter in. But Paul had, not a good feeling about it in his spirit. He perceived that the voyage would end in trouble. But the centurion, Julius, we see in verse 12, went with the majority. And again, we can understand Julius the centurion, his decision here, because on the one hand you had Paul, who he greatly respected, and who he would respect even more as the story develops. But at this point, you know Paul, he's an academic, he's a religious man, he's a great rabbi with the Jewish religion, and all of that. He knows about books, he knows about scriptures, you know, but he doesn't know much about sailing. So I think I'll go with, you know, the captain and the helmsman, you know, the sailors, the owner, who have a lot of experience in these waters. I'll go with them. And so that the decision was thus made. But when they started sailing, we see in verse 13, when the south wind blew softly, supposing they have attained their desire. So when they immediately set out from Fair Havens to Phoenix along the coast of Crete, short journey. They had a nice wind. The wind blew softly, and that gave them, oh yeah, you know, we made the right decision. You know, we're doing good. We're going to get into Phoenix, and then we'll stay there for the winter. They sail close by Crete, the end of verse 13. Then verse 14, but not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called Euroclydon. Which was not a hurricane, but, a sub-hurricane, you know, it was a strong wind, okay? And the seas would be very high and dangerous. So verse 15, so when the ship was caught, we could not head into the wind and we let her drive. So they couldn't make headway against the wind, so they just had to let the wind take them. And they let the ship drive. And running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty. This is like the little lifeboat that floated along behind it. They pulled that in, and that was a big job to get that out of the water because that was hindering them. And then they used cables to undergird the ship, probably ropes. Some say chains, but probably ropes. Fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, they struck sail, and so we were driven. So this is a method, it's called frapping. They wrap these ropes underneath the ship and around the ship, and then they would, you know, winch it tight and would make the ship more secure against the strong waves. At least that was the thinking. And then verse 18, because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened ship. And on the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. They started to lighten the ship and then even started throwing the tackle overboard. And the only thing they were keeping on was that which was of absolute necessity. They were in trouble. And so instead of now landing at the port of Phoenix on the island of Crete, they were now in the Mediterranean Sea, going out into the western part of the Mediterranean Sea. And we'll say a little bit more about that in a few moments. And then we get verse 20, now neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, and all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. So you can see that it was a pretty dark situation on board the ship. The sailors, Julius and his prisoners, and you know, the captain, everybody, they're pretty well discouraged. They feel, well, this is the way it's going to end. You know, we're not going to survive this. We've made a mistake. We've been driven out into the ocean, the deep ocean, and we're in the middle of a storm. And, you know, they knew enough that they felt that they would not survive this. However, verse 21, but after a long abstinence from food, probably because they couldn't eat, it was too rough, they were just hanging on for dear life. Then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. So Paul gives them a little reminder that, you know, they should have listened to him. And this is what we see this with Paul. I don't think this was an evidence of any hubris on his part or I told you so on his part. But Paul had a certain gravitas, you know, and a certain authority. And God was with him. And there was a reason for this because, you know, God would eventually be speaking to these men, especially Julius, I believe. And they would have a different view of Paul by the time they come to the end of this. So there's nothing wrong with what Paul is doing here, as maybe some have suggested. And then in verse 22, and now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve. I love that expression, to whom I belong. You know, we've been purchased with a price. We're not our own. We belong to God if we're a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ, and whom I serve. And everyone who belongs to Christ ought to serve him. And so this is Paul. He's identifying the God to whom he belongs, the God that appeared to him and in the night, who said, sent to him an angel, and who confirmed that none of the lives of the people on the ship would be lost, saying, verse 24, do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you. Well, all who sail with Paul will not be lost. We can look at that as a spiritual metaphor, can't we? Paul's doctrine. But apart from that, just in practical terms, Paul must be brought before Caesar. God had ordained that Paul would testify of the Lord Jesus Christ before the Roman emperor. And so he was going to get there, right? Storm or no storm. God was going to get him there. We see Paul's importance in the counsels of God in this matter. And because so, God was going to have mercy on everyone else on the ship, the Roman centurion, the sailors from whatever country that they emanated from, the captain, the owner, probably from Rome itself, the prisoners, whoever they were, the other prisoners, all would survive this trip. Paul was told this by the angel of God. Verse 25, therefore take heart, men. I love this. Therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island. So Paul's actually prophesying here what was going to happen. They were going to run aground. They would lose the ship, but all would be saved. And he's telling them to take heart. They would not lose their lives. Then we get in verse 27. Now when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down the Adriatic, about midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near land. Now, I should just say here, Luke says the Adriatic Sea. Now, this is really the Gulf of Adria, which is what it was called then. And therefore the Adriatic Sea here. But we should not confuse that with the modern day Adriatic Sea, which is actually, you know, that strait of waters between Italy on the west and the Balkans, countries on the east like Croatia. That's where the Adriatic runs now, or what it's called now anyway. And it's called, the name Adriatic Sea is taken from this, the ancient name. But The Gulf of Adria, or the Adriatic Sea that's mentioned here, is actually the central Mediterranean, which that's what Luke is talking about here. They're out in the central western Mediterranean, bobbing up and down the ocean. They were not up in the strait named the Adriatic Sea between Italy and the Balkans. Just for clarity there, in case there's any confusion with the modern day map, but Luke is really accurate. And so just a little clarification here, but notice about midnight, the sailors sensed they were drawing near some land. You know, back in the seafaring days that we're speaking of here, travel by ship on the ocean was hazardous. They didn't have GPS like we have, or satellites that tell the sailors the weather and where the land is and where the shoals are, and intricate maps, you know, and then electronic gear and sonar and radar, everything that sailors have today. They didn't have any of that. And so sailors, at least experienced sailors at that time, had a very heightened sense of things, right? They had to live by their wits, had to live by their senses. You know, you had to know where the sun was, where the moon was, you know, where the stars were. And but they couldn't see the sun and the stars and the moon in this storm. Everything was clouded over. But they had a sense that they were near land. Perhaps because this increased sensitivity, their senses were increased. This is a known fact about the ancient sailors. They perhaps heard the water. There's a different sound in the water, and maybe a sound of water hitting shoals or rocks. Also, we understand that the ancient sailors, they could pick up things by their smell. They sometimes could smell land, because the air would have a different smell the closer they got to land. But at any rate, however they sensed it, they did sense it. So they took soundings of the water, verse 28, and they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms, and had gone a little farther. They took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. So the water was getting shallower and shallower. So it confirmed their suspicion that they were getting close to land. Verse 29, then fearing lest we should run aground against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. That was a long night. I can guarantee you that was a long night. They prayed for day to come. In verse 30, and as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff, you remember that lifeboat that they had pulled in at the start of their trip when the seas got rough? They started to let it down under the pretense of putting out anchors from the prow. They were pretending they were putting down anchors, but what they were really doing was putting down the lifeboat, and they were going to try to make their getaway in the lifeboat. But verse 21, Paul said to the centurion, Paul comes to Julius and his soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Notice verse 32, then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall, you know. But this time, they believed everything Paul said, okay? They were going to follow Paul. And the soldiers went a little overboard there, you know, and they totally cut the lifeboat away. They weren't going to deviate now from anything that Paul had to offer. And so verse 33, and as the day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day. It was a long 14 days for them. You have waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. Then again, Paul reiterates his prophecy that was given to him by the angel of God, that not one soul would be lost that followed his words and stayed in the boat until God had made the way. So we see the practicality also of Paul. Paul's not one of these people who were so spiritually minded they were no earthly good. You know, he was both spiritual and practical. Perfect balance. We see this in Paul. It said, take some food to strengthen yourself, because we're gonna need the strength. We're gonna need the energy. Okay. So verse 35, when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then they were all encouraged and also took food themselves. So we see Paul, here he is, he takes the bread, he gives thanks for it to the living God for this bread. So we get this testimony, this coming from Paul. He was not shy to declare the God whom he served and followed, who he was, and gave thanks for it. So we see that Paul really had a good testimony amongst these sailors and the others, and even the prisoners, perhaps. They also took food. And we note in verse 37, and in all there were 276 persons on the ship. So Luke specifically records the number of people on board the ship. So verse 38, and so when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw the wheat in the sea. Remember I mentioned that this was an imperial grain ship. So they threw the grain overboard. It was all going to be lost anyway, but it lightened the ship so that it was not so sunken down by weight and low. So give the ship a little more buoyancy above the shoals that they could get further to the shore, because the idea was they're going to run the ship as far as they could up until the shore. That was the plan. So they cast the wheat into the sea. And then we get sort of the culmination of all this, the climax. Verse 39. When it was day, they did not recognize the land. They didn't know where they were, but where they were was the island of Malta. Now, Malta is an island just south of Sicily. Of course, Sicily is an island just south of Italy. Okay, so they were close to Italy. And this is amazing that they didn't know where they were. They were being blown about, and all the places that they could have been blown in the storm, they landed at the destination, right? They landed practically, for all intents and purposes, in Italy. They were very close to Italy, just south of Italy. So God was superintending on this trip. He was getting Paul to Rome to see Caesar. And so he stops now at the, he stops him on the island of Malta. It's amazing, amazing, because God has a testimony to give to the people on Malta. So God is sovereign. So we have to see that, beloved friends, that God is sovereign. And even when things look dark and we're in the storm and we're tossed and tempest, you know, about, if we're the Lord's, if we belong to him and if we serve him, that he works all these things for our good. He has a higher purpose in all of these things. So this is a little thought we may make application of from these events, okay? So verse 39, when it was day, they did not recognize the land, so we know now where they were in Malta, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. That was the plan. And they let go of the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail. They put up the sail so it would get wind, and they pointed in the direction so it would drive the ship towards the shore. The wind made, and they made for shore, in verse 40. But striking a place where the two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast. So the bow stuck fast and remained immovable, couldn't go any farther, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. So you see, it was quite a storm. And the waves now were breaking up the hinder part of the ship. Verse 42, and the soldiers' plan now was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. That was the common practice for Roman soldiers. You remember back in Acts chapter 16 when Paul was in jail in Philippi, and there was the earthquake and the doors were open, and the Philippian jailer thought the prisoners had escaped. He was ready to kill himself, because if a Roman official, a jailer, a warden, allowed his prisoners to escape, then he would be punished with death. So we see that in Acts chapter 12, when the Lord got Peter out of prison, that Herod had the soldiers who were guarding him murdered. He killed them for letting Peter escape. And so we see it was a natural move of the soldiers here was to kill the prisoners, not kill everybody, but just kill the prisoners. But verse 43, but the centurion, wanting to save Paul, Julius now was looking to Paul for everything, but the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded those who could swim should jump overboard first to get to land, and the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was, they all escaped safely to land. So Julius, the centurion, said, nope. Paul says all would be saved. I believe what Paul says now, So every man for himself, jump overboard. Those that swim can swim to land, and those that can't would come on the broken pieces of the ship. And that's indeed what happened. As we'll see when we come to chapter 28, that all survived. Now, the question is, why does Luke go into so much detail in this chapter? Probably more detail than any other part of Paul's experiences. You know, some have questioned this and said, well, wouldn't it have been more valuable, perhaps, for example, to go into more details when he was visiting the assemblies in Greece or Asia, some of his give more of his interactions between the saints there and more details about that? Wouldn't have been more helpful, useful for us? Why does Luke go into all this detail? Well, if you just turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul there recounts his experiences, his sufferings, really, as an apostle of God. And so 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 25, after recounting some of the things that he suffered, you know, his labors, his imprisonments, you know, the different times that he was scourged by the Jews and so on, and being stoned. He mentions in verse 25, three times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day I have been in the deep, in journeys often, perils of waters and perils of robbers, and so on and so on. But he mentions here in verse 25, three times I was shipwrecked. Now, 2 Corinthians was written before the events of chapter 27 of Acts. Paul, by the time of their crashing on the island of Malta, the shipwreck, had already written 2 Corinthians, actually about 3 years previous to this. So chapter 27, the shipwreck of Acts chapter 27, is actually Paul's fourth shipwreck. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 25 mentions he had three. So we can add this fourth to the list. And so Luke expounds upon the details here and gives us sort of a snapshot of who the Apostle Paul really is, just through the details and how he reacted under the stress and how he was the Lord's servant and how the authority that had been given to him of the Lord. I believe all these details really, really reinforce this and bring this out. There's another aspect here too. I'm not going to go into the details of it, but some have seen Acts chapter 27 and the sea voyage as sort of a bit of an allegory, and there's something to it, a bit of an allegory, a bit of a prophecy of the history of the church, how the church sets out with Paul under arrest. The church history sort of begins really with Paul. As we see the close of Acts, as the history of Christendom unfolds, of the church unfolds, Paul under arrest, but it ends with a shipwreck. And so at the end of the trip, we see the Christians all split up in our various groups, you know, and parties and so on. The outward testimony of the church in ruin, but everyone who is the Lord's will be saved. And so we get this here. Not everyone who sailed with Paul was saved. All the Lord's own will be saved. Not one will be lost. Not one of those who belong to Christ will be lost in the end, regardless of the breakup of the outward testimony of what we call the church. Okay, Christendom, whatever name you want to put on it. And so as you go through the chapter, you see some of the details. You know, they should have listened to Paul. And when they didn't listen to Paul, then they got into trouble. And that's exactly church history. You know, they... in church history, as soon as Paul's doctrine was dropped, the church descends into the Dark Ages. And we see that in verse 20, when neither sun nor stars had appeared for many days, no small tempest beat on us, and all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. And so the Dark Ages, the heavenly calling was lost, justification by faith was lost. But then we see in verse 21, after a long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst. Then we see Paul coming to the fore. And so we see Paul, the doctrine of Paul, justification by faith, coming fore in the Reformation, and then the heavenly calling coming forth later, and the recovery of the truth in the 19th century, the hope of the Lord's covering. So all these things can be sort of gleaned from here. You know, sometimes we have to be a little careful of over-allegorizing. That's a danger, especially from the New Testament. Okay, we want to use caution in that. But there is something to it. And I'm not going to go into all the details of it in these expositions. It's not really the point of these videos. But for those who are interested in it, I would recommend a booklet. And that's by Gordon Hayhoe. And the title of the booklet is Paul's Voyage from Fair Havens to Melita. And you can get it through Bible Truth Publishers in Addison, Illinois. They're the publishers of it. I'm sure through Believer's Bookshelf, both Canada and the U.S., they may have it in stock. And if they don't, they can order it in as well. So either three of those places, you could probably get this little booklet. And the author, Gordon Hayhoe, goes into the details much more than I have here. I just wanted to touch on it because we're trying to find the reason why we get so much detail on this ship, this journey by ship, by Paul, as he sailed from Caesarea on his way to Rome. Well, may the Lord encourage you, and we can glean from this that no matter what the storms of life are, that God, our God, is sovereign. He works all things for our good. He has a higher purpose, and we can trust in his dealings with us. Amen.